A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been watching the annual summer ritual. Forest fires sweep through the eastern Mediterranean. Local teams get overwhelmed, and then something quietly remarkable happens. Countries that don't exactly send each other holiday cards start sending planes. Greece helps Israel. Israel helps Greece. Italy's in the mix. Cyprus, too. And what's got him curious is the machinery underneath that. Not the heroism, but the actual process. Who picks up the phone? What gets said? How a request for help moves from a burning hillside to a foreign air force scrambling tankers? He also wants to know why this is one of the few domains where politics seems to take a back seat, because the political climate between some of these countries is, let's call it, complicated. And why is Israel specifically known for earthquake rescue? And how does that compare to its role in firefighting?
Everyone pictures a prime minister calling another prime minister in the middle of the night, and that does happen at the very end, but the scaffolding underneath is bureaucratic and it's been built over decades. The mechanism that actually routes these requests is called the EU Civil Protection Mechanism. That's the central clearinghouse for disaster assistance across Europe and the Mediterranean basin. Israel's not an EU member, but it's a participating state in the mechanism, which means it both sends and receives through the same channels as everyone else.
So it's less a phone tree and more a ticketing system.
Exactly, a ticketing system. A country declares an emergency, assesses what it needs, and submits a formal request for assistance through the EU's Emergency Response Coordination Center in Brussels. That request goes out to all participating states simultaneously. Anyone who can help offers what they've got. The requesting country accepts or declines specific offers, and then the center coordinates logistics.
The short answer is that the people moving the planes aren't talking to the people having the diplomatic fights. They're on entirely separate channels.
Right. And the mechanism that makes this possible comes in two flavors. For EU members, Greece and Italy, there's the EU Civil Protection Mechanism, the UCPM. The agreement was signed in 2008, though the relationship had been building since the late 90s. Israel's actually been one of the more active non-EU participants. They've sent firefighting planes to Greece in 2021, to Cyprus multiple times. They received help from Greece and Italy during the Carmel fire in 2010.
Israel isn't in the EU, so it's not in that mechanism. So how does Israel get help, or give it?
Bilateral agreements. Israel has standing firefighting cooperation agreements with Greece, signed in 2011, renewed in 2021, and with Italy. These pre-established customs clearance, visa waivers for firefighting crews, and fuel supply arrangements. Zero. They were using crop dusters retrofitted with water tanks. The Carmel fire killed 44 people, mostly prison service cadets whose bus got trapped on the road.
That's the detail that does the work. The fire chief calls the fire chief.
But during the fire itself, they were completely dependent on foreign assistance, and the requests went out through channels that were far less organized than what exists now.
So the modern system was forged in the failure of the old one. There's a pattern.
It's the pattern for most of emergency management, honestly. The other piece Daniel mentioned is earthquake response, and that's a different mechanism entirely, that runs through INSEROG, the International Search and Rescue Advisory Group, which operates under the UN. Israel's National Rescue Unit, the Home Front Command Search and Rescue Brigade, is one of only a handful of teams worldwide that's INSEROG classified at the heavy level, meaning they can deploy a fully self-sufficient field hospital with surgical capacity within hours of an earthquake anywhere in the world.
And heavy classification means what, practically?
It means they don't need anything from the host country. They bring their own water, power, food, medical supplies, satellite communications. They can operate for 2 weeks without resupply. The classification audit is brutal. International evaluators show up unannounced and run a 36-hour simulation. If your field hospital's water purification fails, you get downgraded.
That specificity matters, because the receiving country is plugging these assets into an existing operation.
That's the part most coverage misses. When aid arrives, the foreign crews don't operate independently. They're integrated into the host country's incident command structure. The receiving country's fire service retains operational command. And it's not just reputation. Being INSIRAD classified means your teams get priority access to disaster zones.
What about the practical addicts? Different equipment, different procedures.
Israel's field hospital was on the ground and treating patients within something like 38 hours of the quake, and it ended up being the largest field hospital operating in Haiti. They treated over 1,000 patients, performed more than 300 surgeries. The 2011 Israel-Greece agreement included a technical annex specifying radio frequencies, fuel types, and water source coupling standards.
So someone sat down years ago and figured out which hose fittings match.
But when the request went out through INSIRAD channels, Israel offered a field hospital, Haiti accepted, and the whole thing was coordinated through the UN's On-Site Operations Coordination Center.
Let's talk about cost. Who pays for all this?
Under the EU mechanism, the requesting country covers 75% of transport costs, and the EU covers the remaining 25%. For bilateral agreements, terms vary. Right, and that threshold is entirely set by the requesting country. There's no external authority that declares a country is officially overwhelmed. It's a sovereign decision.
72 hours is interesting. That covers the acute phase of most wildfire emergencies.
Most countries could put boots on the ground, but the number of countries that maintain a fleet of heavy firefighting aircraft is tiny.
How tiny?
Globally, maybe 15 countries have dedicated large air tankers. Everyone else relies on helicopters with buckets or smaller single-engine planes. So when a fire gets big enough that you need a Bariev or a Canadair dropping 30,000 liters per pass, you're calling abroad no matter how good your domestic fire service is.
Let's put some specific cases on this. July 2023, Greece.
Greece faced catastrophic fires, the largest ever recorded in the EU. The request went out through the ERCC, and 11 countries responded simultaneously. And that's the quiet shift that's happened over the last 20 years. Disaster response used to be framed as self-sufficiency. A capable country handles its own emergencies.
The Air Tractor is a single-engine aircraft, isn't it? Not the massive flying boats people picture.
Single-engine turboprop carries about 3,000 liters of water or retardant. It's designed for agricultural spraying originally, adapted for firefighting. Very maneuverable, can operate from shorter runways. It's mostly true with asterisks. The mechanism itself is apolitical. When Greece submitted its request for assistance during the 2021 fires, the offer list included countries with whom Greece had active diplomatic tensions.
And the CL-415 is the one that scoops water from the sea.
So if there's a country whose presence would be politically untenable domestically, they just don't make the acceptance call. That deployment happened within 12 hours of the request.
12 hours! From another country!
The offers circulate anonymously in the initial round. Actually, the requesting country sees capabilities and timelines before they see flags. Foreign ministry statements were cool. Yet in August, when fires broke out in the Jerusalem hills and forced evacuations, Greece dispatched those two CL-41Ts within hours.
So the operational channel survived what the political channel didn't.
The cooperation is real and genuine in the moment, but it doesn't resolve underlying conflicts. Greece and Turkey have exchanged firefighting assistance multiple times while in active disputes over airspace and maritime boundaries. The planes land, they drop water, they go home, and the next day the rhetoric resumes.
So it's a temporary suspension, not a thaw.
A ceasefire in the argument, not a resolution. And that's fine. It doesn't need to be more than that. The point is that the mechanism creates a space where the suspension is possible without anyone having to make a grand political gesture. You're not signing the peace accord, you're accepting a water bomber. The 2021 renewal was a technical update, not a political event.
Let's shift to the earthquake side, because Daniel specifically asked about the comparison. Israel is known for earthquake rescue in a way it's not known for firefighting. Why?
The trigger is typically when the incident commander on the ground reports that available resources are insufficient for the projected escalation. That goes up through the Fire and Rescue Authority to NEMA, and NEMA makes the call to activate the EU mechanism.
That's a very specific capability. Most countries don't maintain a standing unit for international earthquake deployment.
The foreign ministry handles the diplomatic offer. The defense ministry handles the operational deployment. Second, decades of experience responding to building collapses from conflict and terrorism. The unit has seen more collapsed concrete structures than almost any other rescue organization in the world.
That's a grim expertise to develop.
The Haiti Field Hospital generated more positive international coverage for Israel than any deliberate PR campaign could have bought. But the calculus is also operational. Every deployment is a training exercise for the home front command. You can't simulate the chaos of a real earthquake zone. The only way to maintain readiness is to deploy to actual disasters.
So the receiving country gets a field hospital, and Israel gets a live fire training exercise that also happens to generate goodwill. That's a remarkably efficient transaction.
It's the definition of mutual benefit, and it explains why countries maintain these capabilities even when they're expensive. Israel's heavy search and rescue classification costs millions annually to maintain, equipment, training, readiness exercises. But the alternative is losing the capability entirely, and then when the next Haiti happens, you're not in the game.
Let me push on something. You said the mechanism is apolitical, and I believe that's true of the EU Civil Protection Mechanism and INSERAG at the operational level.
Lower footprint, shorter duration, less political visibility. But the integration challenges are real. The command structure, the equipment compatibility, the language issues. Earthquake rescue avoids all of that by being self-contained. Yes, and that's the limit of the system. The mechanism only works if countries choose to participate. It doesn't compel anyone to offer. During the 2023 Turkish earthquakes, the offers flooded in from over 100 countries.
And yet the political insulation mechanism works for both. The National Rescue Unit deploys through its own channels too.
Same principle. The request comes through the Home Front Command's international liaison, not through the Foreign Ministry's political desk. And that's why the pre-existing relationships matter so much. The Eastern Mediterranean Fire Cooperation works partly because the countries involved all face the same threat.
Let's talk about the reciprocity dynamic, because I think that's what keeps this system oiled.
When the winds are blowing from the same direction and the fuel loads are the same, you develop a professional kinship that operates beneath the political surface. And Israel has sent aid to both countries in return. This creates a norm of mutual obligation that outlasts any single government.
You help me, I help you. But it's not transactional in the moment. It's a standing expectation.
The operational people build relationships that then make the political decisions easier. When the request comes in, the fire commissioner can tell the minister, "I know these people, they're professional, we can work with them." That personal trust at the operational level is the grease that makes the whole thing move. Firefighting is a small world. The Israeli crew that deployed to Greece in 2023 had trained with Greek firefighters in joint exercises. The Greek crew that came to Israel in 2021 had hosted Israeli counterparts the year before.
So the personal relationships mirror the institutional ones.
The INSERAG system is designed for a response that begins literally within minutes of the event. Teams are on standby rotation. Israel's Home Front Command maintains a team that can be wheels up within 4 hours of a formal request, and the request process is compressed accordingly. For earthquakes, there's a pre-approved framework. Countries don't negotiate each deployment from scratch.
The earthquake deployments create a different kind of soft power. Israel deploying a field hospital to Turkey after an earthquake that killed tens of thousands. That's visible in a way firefighting planes aren't.
And it's intentional. The National Rescue Unit deployments serve a diplomatic function, even if that's not their primary purpose. The Turkey 2023 deployment, 450 personnel, that was covered globally. That's why the authority is delegated. The Defense Minister or the Home Front Command Chief has pre-authorized deployment for certain categories of disaster. They don't need to wake anyone up.
Firefighting aid is quieter. Two planes, a support crew, a few days of water drops. It doesn't make the same headlines.
By the time the political leadership is fully briefed, the advance team is already at the airbase loading equipment.
That level of delegated authority is itself a statement about how seriously a country takes this.
It's a statement about lessons learned. Every country that's been caught flat-footed by a disaster eventually builds faster authorization chains. The countries that haven't been through it yet still have the slow ones. If climate change intensifies wildfire seasons across the Mediterranean, and every projection says it will, we're looking at a future where multiple countries have major fires simultaneously.
And the same aircraft can't be in two places at once.
The political relationship at the time was strained, but the operational relationship between the disaster response communities was intact. The Homefront Command team operated in the Adiyaman region and extracted something like 19 people from collapsed buildings.
19 lives pulled out of rubble, and the political relationship didn't improve one degree.
Not one degree. And both sides understood that going in. The deployment wasn't framed as a diplomatic overture, it was framed as a professional obligation. Israel has a capability, Turkey had a need, the mechanism routed the request, and the professionals did their jobs. The politicians stayed out of it except for the initial authorization.
That's almost more interesting than if it had led to a thaw. It suggests the mechanism is robust enough to function, even when the political temperature is at its coldest.
That's the thesis of the whole disaster diplomacy literature. The cooperation is genuine but contained. It doesn't spill over into other domains. And that's not a failure. It's the design spec.
Hilbert's been quiet back there.
I was in Nepal.
The primary asset is the ELAD squadron. That's the air tractor fleet, single-engine firefighting planes.
2015. I worked logistics for the Foreign Ministry's Humanitarian Aid Desk. My job was arranging the charter flights, customs clearance, and ground transport for the National Rescue Unit deployment. 260 personnel, 100 tons of equipment. I spent 3 weeks in Kathmandu.
What's the thing nobody talks about?
Paperwork. Everyone talks about the politics of aid, but the real headache is the forms. When we sent the team to Nepal, we had to get clearance for 40 different types of medical equipment that Nepal's customs had never seen before, including a portable CT scanner that the Nepali officer thought was a bomb.
There's also an EU funding pool that can cover transport costs for particularly expensive deployments. Bilaterally, it's negotiated case by case.
It's a cylinder about the size of a small refrigerator. It doesn't look like medical equipment unless you know what you're looking at. The diplomatic clearance came through in 4 hours. The customs clearance took 3 days. I sat in a warehouse with a Nepali major who wanted to open every crate. International aid is 10% heroism and 90% filling out the right form in triplicate.
The firefighting agreements are simpler, I'd imagine.
Much simpler. Planes drop water. You don't need to explain what a water bomber does. The equipment is standardized. Hoses, pumps, nozzles. The customs issues are minimal. Earthquake deployment is where you learn that the boring stuff is what actually determines whether the mission works.
The coordination challenge is that everyone's peak demand overlaps. When Greece is burning, Israel might also be burning, and then the pool of available aircraft shrinks to whatever's not already committed.
The field hospital had full surgical capability. You can't do surgery on crushed limbs without imaging. We brought an operating theater, an ICU, a pharmacy, and a radiology unit. It all fit in cargo pallets.
So the system works best for the second fire of the season, not the first.
That was the part nobody planned for. We brought our own satellite link because Nepal's phone network collapsed in the first aftershock. Standard procedure, the unit is self-sufficient for communications. But within 48 hours, the Nepali Prime Minister's office was using our satellite link to coordinate the overall relief effort. We were supposed to be the rescue team, and we ended up being the telecom provider for the entire government.
It hasn't happened yet, mostly because of cost. A single Canadair costs about $35 million, and a standing fleet of 6 would need annual operating budgets in the tens of millions. Nobody wants to be the country that foots the bill.
It happens every time. You show up with a capability nobody else has, and suddenly you're doing things that weren't in the deployment order. The Nepal deployment was supposed to be search and rescue and medical. We ended up doing water purification, power generation, and running the communications grid for the government. The satellite link stayed active for 2 weeks after the rescue phase ended.
And that's not in any bilateral agreement.
The agreements cover the deployment. They don't cover what happens when the Nepali Prime Minister walks into your field hospital and asks to use your phone. You figure it out.
Prevention doesn't have a ribbon-cutting ceremony. There's no photo op for the fire that didn't happen.
It's less likely with firefighting because the mission is narrower. You're there to drop water and leave. Earthquake deployments are open-ended. You set up a field hospital, you're there for weeks. The mission grows because the need grows.
What does the actual sequence look like, minute by minute, when a fire crosses the threshold?
Scanned over 200 patients in the first week. The Nepali officer, who thought it was a bomb, ended up helping us uncrate it. He'd never seen one before. By the end of the deployment, he was showing other officials how it worked.
The incident commander on the ground determines that available aerial assets, Israel's own ELAD squadron, can't contain the spread. That assessment goes to the Fire and Rescue Authority's Operations Center, which contacts NEMA.
The firefighting agreements are actually easier in one way people don't think about. With earthquakes, you're dealing with a country that's collapsed. The government might be partially functional. The customs system might be destroyed. Nepal's port of entry was a military airfield with a folding table and a handwritten ledger. With wildfires, the country is still functioning. The airports are open, the customs systems work, the fuel depots are operational. It's logistically simpler, even though the operation is more integrated.
So the earthquake deployments are logistically harder, but operationally simpler. You bring everything. Firefighting is logistically easier, but operationally more complex. You integrate.
That's right. And the paperwork for earthquakes is worse because you're bringing things customs has never seen. For firefighting, you're bringing aircraft that are well-known types. The customs officer in Athens knows what a CL-415 is. The customs officer in Kathmandu doesn't know what a portable CT scanner is.
Israel's operations center evaluates the offers against the operational need and accepts the ones that fit. The ERCC coordinates the logistics, flight paths, landing clearances, fuel arrangements.
The charter flights alone were north of $2 million. The whole deployment, with personnel costs, equipment, and sustainment, I'd estimate $8 to $10 million. Israel covered it. The Nepali government offered to reimburse, but the arrangement was that it was aid, not a loan.
The satellite link. Who paid for the extra 2 weeks?
We did. It wasn't in the budget. Someone in the foreign ministry signed off on it after the fact. That's how these things work. You do what's needed and sort out the accounting later.
Yes. The politics isn't put aside. It's bypassed. The mechanism creates a channel that runs underneath the political layer. The operational people have their own relationships, their own protocols, their own decision-making authority.
The firefighting agreements are designed to be clean. Limited duration, limited scope, limited cost. That's why they survive political tensions. Nobody has to go to Parliament and ask for $8 million in supplemental funding because a firefighting deployment ran long.
The system is elegant precisely because it's narrow.
It's narrow until it isn't. The satellite link in Nepal wasn't supposed to happen. But it did, and it mattered more than anything else we brought.
There's a deeper question here that Daniel's prompt gestures at, but doesn't quite ask. Why does this domain get the bypass when so many others don't? What's special about disaster response that lets it operate below the political radar?
I think there are three things. First, the threat is shared and visible. Everyone in the Eastern Mediterranean watches the same forest burn. There's no ambiguity about whether the problem is real. Second, the response is time-critical in a way that most government functions aren't. You can argue about trade policy for 6 months. You can't argue about water bombers for 6 hours. The urgency forces a different decision-making mode.
The depoliticized technical channel model, the fire chief calling the fire chief, might actually be a template. If fire services can maintain cooperation despite political tensions, maybe other technical agencies can too. Water sharing during droughts, heat wave response coordination, sea level rise mitigation planning.
The mechanism works because it's boring. It's not a diplomatic breakthrough. It's a pre-signed agreement about hose fittings and radio frequencies, administered by people whose job is putting out fires, not managing international relations. And that's why disaster diplomacy doesn't generalize. People keep hoping it will, that the cooperation will spill over, that the goodwill will create openings for broader diplomatic progress. The evidence says it doesn't.
The next time you see a news clip of a Greek water bomber over an Israeli forest fire, or an Israeli plane over a Greek mountain, that plane didn't fly because of a diplomatic breakthrough. The mechanism is a tool, not a metaphor.
Right. And treating it as a metaphor for what could be possible in other domains actually undersells what's impressive about it. The impressive thing isn't that it might lead to peace, it's that it works even when there's no peace. The reality is, it's driven by technical agencies with pre-existing operational agreements that operate independently of political relationships. The politics happens when the agreement is signed. After that, it's just operations.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently once ran the communications grid for the government of Nepal.
the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, Singapore, China, Russia. It's a small group. And the classification isn't permanent. Teams get reevaluated every 5 years.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.